You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello, friends. Welcome. This is the 74th episode or something like that. I wish that I had numbered them. There's a guy in the FinCon podcast group. He's sort of the leader of the crew. He encouraged us not to number episodes. Apple was opposed to it at one time for some reason. So I think he said it messed with the algorithm. So I never numbered my episodes, but I sure wish I had. And I may go back to it. It's just so easy to reference prior episodes when you number them. If you love baseball, I've got a great episode for you today. My guest is Richard Quickie. After working for the local utility in New Orleans for 40 years, he worked in IT. He started writing. And in 2011, he wrote a book about baseball's family ties. Then began doing research and writing for SABRE, which is the Society for American Baseball Research. He grew up in North Mississippi, attended Mississippi State University, and then he came to New Orleans straight out of college. So since he's been here 40 years, he claims to be a New Orleanian, and I would say that's right. Richard has also contributed to sports-related websites, national publications, print magazines. He's sort of a big deal. The reason Richard and I originally connected was because he had written a biography piece on my grandfather, Fats D'Antonio. Fortuitous timing, because it just so happens that I'm living in New Orleans for 1 year, and the article came out in March. So I wanted to get him on the podcast. He's got great stories, great insight on different players throughout every era. And I'm so glad I connected with him because he's also just really gracious with his time and his knowledge and has shared with me all sorts of Fats D'Antonio pictures and articles that I didn't even know existed. So I'm really grateful to have met him. There's one article in particular about my Pawpaw Fats that he sent to me a few days ago. And while I was reading it, I kept telling my wife, who was sitting across from me, I kept saying, "This is the best article I've read in a long time." Because it turns out I'm even more like my grandfather than I ever knew or would have known had I never read this article. So it was really cool to read. You know what? I have time. I'm going to read it to you now. You have a fast forward button, right? If you don't want to hear it, you can skip straight to our discussion. But yeah, let me read this to you. I'll pull it up. The article was written May 4th, 1988, published in the Times-Picayune. It's called Diamond Memories by Ronnie Vergitz. It reads, "The Fat Man. John D'Antonio is the name on the birth certificate, but since his Jesuit schoolboy days, he's always been called Fats, or Uncle Fatty, or the Fat Man. He's never really been fat, just short and squatty, but the name somehow fits perfectly. From the lunch counter of his Bienville Street sandwich shop, behind the RTA barns, he waits now for the bus drivers and mechanics who come in wanting pork chop sandwiches and pinto beans. Fats knows buses, trains too. For 11 years until 1949, he crisscrossed two-thirds of America in them while playing professional baseball. After the Monday lunch business trails off, he begins to fill the afternoon silence with baseball talk. Someone mentions the ineptness of the Orioles. You think the club's fining him for all those mental mistakes, he wonders? When I played, you struck out, okay. You dropped a ball, okay. But if they told you to hit to right and you hit to left, they took your money. You swung when you should have bunted, they took your money. It wasn't a lot to take. Fat's first pro salary was $65 a month, catching in the Texas Valley League, playing games on fields that cracked a half a foot in the afternoon heat. I lost 30 pounds that summer. I come home a 115-pound guy named Fats. Red-faced and raw-voiced, Fats still sounds like he belongs in a dugout, baiting an umpire or needling the other team's pitcher. It was that feistiness that got him his most coveted prize in baseball, a $10 a month raise from Branch Rickey. For the uninitiated, Branch Rickey was a general manager for the Cardinals, and later the Pirates and the Dodgers. A brilliant visionary, he was also a legendary dime squeezer. One spring, he offered Pirates star Ralph Kiner a $10,000 cut. Kiner protested that he'd led the league in home runs. And where did we finish, Ralph? Last, Mr. Ricky. We can do that without you, Ralph. His roomie did it better. So that was Fats' foe when he got the news one spring training that he was being demoted to Springfield, Missouri. Ricky was in the stands and Fats went over and started talking to him. I just kept yapping because if Ricky got a chance to talk, he'd talk you into playing for nothing. Springfield had no catcher, so I had him over a barrel. I said I wanted a chance to move up and had just gotten married. He liked that. He said, "What will it take, John?" And I said, $10 a month more. And he laughed. So I added and trained fare for my wife, there and back. Fats did well at Springfield, and so did his roommate, a sore-arm pitcher-turned-outfielder. One day a telegram arrived at their buck-a-day rooming house in order for one of them to report up to Rochester. We were both doing good, Fats rasps. We didn't know who it was for as we opened it. It was for his roomie, a guy who went on to bat his way into the Hall of Fame, a guy named Stan Musial. There's a photograph of Fats and Musial pinned to the lunch counter wall. So old, the ends are curling. But Fats no longer has good things to say about Musial. Seems like in later years, Musial didn't act after Fats called him on behalf of two friends seeking a Budweiser distributorship. And I had paid his last month's rent at Springfield and gave him all the canned goods, Fats reasons. You hear me, baby? The code, the imperative, never to snub an old roomie, is still in place in Fats' life. Turn down manager job. Eventually, Fats scrapped his way into the major leagues, playing backup catcher for Brooklyn for a season and a half. Leo DeRocher was managing the Dodgers in Fats' first game against the Giants in the old Polo Grounds. DeRocher ordered the first three Giants batters knocked down with close pitches. "When I come up to bat, whee, right at my head," Fats says. I look up at Lombardi, the Giants catcher, and say, "What the hell?" Lombardi just looks over at my pitcher in the on-deck circle and says, "And that jackass is going down too." In his second season at Brooklyn, Fats sprained his wrist and was sent down to St. Paul. The next year at St. Paul, he felt a pop in his shoulder while warming up. His arm began to lose its vigor. The Dodgers offered him a job as a minor league manager in New Hampshire, and Fats turned it down. He's sorry now. The team would have included blacks. And in those segregated times, Fats didn't want to come home and be jibed at for managing blacks. "Today," he says wryly, "I wait on him for penny matches." He came home to play one more year, aching arm and all, for the Pelicans. He and old Jesuit teammate Russ Gildig had bought a little restaurant and bar on Tulane Avenue, a few blocks from the ballpark. He figured playing for the Pels would be good for business. "I'd play with a shot of Novocaine, which would wear off about the fourth inning," he says. "But after the home games, I'd bring everybody back to the place." The place provided Fats with a living until 1972 when he moved to his present location. "Hey," he says in his friendly growl voice, "I raised three kids that turned out fine. That's good. I caught 28 games for the Dodgers and we won 25 of them. They wrote that in the New York Times. I come a long way for a little man." The fat man, a guy that once squeezed an extra $10 out of Branch Rickey. Nothing little about him. Please enjoy my chat with Mr. Richard Quickie. Richard, thank you for joining me today. I'm glad you're here.
Glad to be with you. Nice day for a discussion.
It is a beautiful day. I call this my studio, but it is outdoors on the back porch in New Orleans.
Not a better place.
Mm-mm. You've lived here all your life?
No, actually, I was originally from North Mississippi in the Mississippi Delta. Went to school at Mississippi State and came here straight out of school, so I've been here close to 50 years now, and so this is pretty much home for me, though.
Mississippi State took 2 of 3 from LSU last weekend, is that right?
That was pretty good.
Pretty good like
pitching by the state pitchers, yep.
Now, LSU has some serious MLB prospects this year, right?
The two pitchers, I think, Jaden Hill and Landon Marceau, are ranked in the top 100 in Baseball America's preseason. So I think they probably have the best chances of getting drafted. You
know? I know Jaden Hill throws upper 90s consistently, and that's not even his best pitch. A slider is his best pitch.
I know he was throwing pretty hard the other night. Now he gave up a few hits, and State got ahead of him, and he couldn't come back. But he's a good ball player.
When I was a kid, I always thought facing 95 miles an hour would just be the most fascinating thing. when I faced Josh Beckett in high school, it was so effortless. Like, it didn't seem like 95 from the dugout. Now, once you got up to the plate, it was like, whoa. But their motions are so, and I imagine Jaden Hill is like this. I really haven't seen him much, but it's just such a fluid motion. And when they let go of the ball, because they're 6'4", 6'5", it's like they're on top of you. And so when they release the ball, if the mound is 60 feet, 6 inches from the plate, they release the ball and their hand is like 51 and a half feet from you or something like that. And then pop, it hits the glove. I was playing at Blinn Junior College. This was the summer before my senior year of high school. And Beckett and Gutzman were cocky. Philip Gutzman was his catcher. Gutzman played at Spring High School with Beckett. And so you never wanted to do anything to inflate their head any bigger. And I was hitting leadoff. This is a summer select league sort of game. And the first pitch of the game, I took it. It was right down the poo-poo. And I went, holy shit. And Gutzman looked at me and he winked and he threw it back to Beckett. And I thought, dang it, I did not. That just came out of my mouth, that holy shit.
Right.
That's how fast it was coming. I like to ask about personal finance and investing and retirement. I know that you worked in IT for 40 years.
Correct. Yeah.
How were you able to retire? Was it a pension plan through work? I know you worked for the local utility, correct?
Correct, yeah. I kind of did it the old-fashioned way. The 401ks came into being about the time I started working. And so, you know, maxed out on contributions there. I did have a pension plan. Unfortunately, I didn't get the full benefit of it because I left early from the employer. But it was pretty much don't get in a lot of trouble, don't borrow a lot of money.
So living within your means.
Living within your means. I had four children and had to put through Catholic school, so that it took a little bit of a drain. And
yeah.
Then, of course, then they went to college. But I managed to get through it, and just hard work. And fortunately, I had a good employer that paid a decent salary, and we made out okay.
So were you saving like 10% on average, would you say?
Yeah, probably 10% in total, yeah.
Yep. Okay. So. And were you targeting a specific age that you wanted to retire?
Actually, I thought I had the grand idea that I was going to retire at 55, and then it didn't work out. But I got at 60, I was able to get away from them. I had a life change at around 55, and that caused me not to really get there. Had a death in the family, but it worked out. So I was glad to walk away at 60, and hadn't regretted it since. You know, every day is Saturday now, right?
I know that feeling. Yeah. Yes. So how did you get into writing? Is that something you knew you would do once you retired?
Not really. I'd been a baseball fan all my life. I used to keep lists of things about baseball, and one of them was about family relatives, you know, fathers, sons, brothers. And when I quit working, I was going through all my lists again, and I saw that I had a fairly lengthy list around these baseball family ties. And so I said, well, let me try writing. And I got it accomplished. It was more like a reference book that had probably had a limited audience. But it was something I did. And so actually the way I got into more to the writing was actually, we'll talk about your grandfather. I belong to the Society for American Baseball Research, and one of the things that they do is they put out books about teams or about eras. Your grandfather, Fats D'Antonio, was one of the players that they needed an author in a book about replacement players during World War II, and he was one of the five or so Dodger players. Apparently, they were having trouble finding authors for all of these, and so one day I got an email that says, hey, you're from New Orleans, why don't you try this? And so I did. And the editor, when I signed up for it, he came back and he says, well, you know, this is Fats D'Antonio, not Fats Domino, right? And I was like, yeah, okay, I got it. So through that process, I mean, it works out well that you get a lot of support, you get a lot of help. And I found the first one was tough, and then the next one got better, and the next one got better. And so actually, I think I've actually improved over the last 8 or so years I've been doing this. And so, you know, I'm on now. When a new project comes up, I'm one of the guys they call, and so I like that. And in fact, I got recommended by one of the editors outside of Sabre to contribute to a book about the Milwaukee Brewers County Old County Stadium. So I'm going to write a chapter about the 1982 Harvey Wallbangers. Remember that? Maybe that was before your time. But they got to a World Series that year, and so it worked out pretty good for me. So.
Milwaukee, their stadium was similar to Cleveland's and the one in Arlington, right? The Texas Rangers Stadium. Wasn't it just rather bland and
the old stadium? Yeah, was like Arlington's. Originally, I think they had a minor league team there for a number of years, and then of course the Milwaukee Braves moved there in 1954, I think, from Boston. They packed that stadium; it held like 45,000 fans, and even up into when the Milwaukee Brewers moved there, they were still drawing 50,000 fans. And in fact, if you go to Miller Park today in Milwaukee, and I've been to a few games there, they packed that stadium. I mean, it's a rabid fan base there in Milwaukee. You wouldn't think that. I guess similar to, you know, to the Packers and, you know, Green Bay and whatever. So it's a thriving baseball community. I wish we had that here. But
well, I want to get to why we don't have that here. When I think of the old Milwaukee Brewers, I think of Daryl Hamilton.
Correct.
Who's a local product.
He was a Nickel State player. Right?
Nickel State alum. Yeah. Murdered tragically.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. 1982 would have been the year Robin Yount was playing there, Paul Molitor was playing there, Ted Simmons, Raleigh Fingers. They had a number of future Hall of Famers on that team.
So your first gig was writing about relatives in baseball?
Correct.
When you talked about your first one?
Right.
And so that was a book that you self-published?
Correct, yes.
And so can you talk about that process and how it led you to writing about my grandfather ultimately?
So I got interested in my first venture in writing was through the book, like I said, and I didn't have a lot of help with it. I self-published, I was on my own. But then I guess I got the itch to continue to do that, and that's I got contacted again by a Sabre member, said, hey, why don't you try this? And so the Fats D'Antonio biography for this book about replacement players was my first time writing a story about a player.
So it's like a chapter in the book.
It's a chapter
now
in the
I
book.
Understand. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So
very cool. So what did you learn about him? You probably know way more about my grandfather than I do. He died when I was 12.
Okay. He was 5'8", 165. Not very big for a baseball player, at least in nowadays terms. He played on some of the Jesuit high school baseball teams in the 30s that were like – they were like a dynasty. They were like the Yankees were at a high school level. And the team that – one of the teams he played on was in 1936. Their entire team made the all-prep team. Seven of them were on the first team, and the other five were on the second team. So he was a catcher as a high school player, and then in 1938, he got signed by the St. Louis Cardinals, and they played him as a shortstop initially, and he did quite well at the lower levels, Class D, Class C. In fact, one of his teams he played on was at Springfield, Missouri. He was a teammate of Stan Musial. Fats and his wife and Stan Musial and their wife shared an apartment, so they would go fishing on off days, and that relationship lasted their lifetime. They stayed in touch that long. But anyway, so he actually did pretty well in the low minors, and then got a chance with the New Orleans Pelicans here in New Orleans, and he did okay. But then World War II kind of got in the way, and he 1943 he wasn't drafted into the service, but he had to hold a defense related job. So he worked at a shipyard here in New Orleans. And he actually played in the home games of the Pelicans when they went away. Of course, he didn't play, but when they were playing at home. So he got into about 40 games that year. But then he also played on a local semi-pro team at the same time. So very different times, right, for how baseball was played then.
And is that because he had to work?
Yeah, he had to work. Day job was at the shipyard. And then he was playing baseball, you know, I guess in evenings when they, you know, were playing games, or on weekends, you know, when they had home games.
So there must have been other players that had the same situation.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that was common for a lot of the players at the time. After playing with the Pelicans then, that, again, the major leagues were short on players. A lot of them had gotten into, were drawn into the service, you know, military drafted into the service. And in 1944, the Brooklyn Dodgers were struggling. Their team was pretty bad. Leo DeRocher was the coach, manager, and he wanted to get a view of some of the up-and-coming players for his team. So Fats was doing well at for the Pelicans, and he got called up at the end of the season and actually played in three major league games. So the next season, at the beginning of the season, this would be 1945, their Dodgers primary catcher got called into service into the Navy. So he actually made the team out of spring training and started for probably about 6 weeks or so, but he couldn't hit enough. I guess he's probably too small, really. I mean, to think about it. But he didn't hit well enough to stick around, so he wound up getting back into the minors, and then that played the rest of his career until he was age 29. He finally quit and wound up with the Pelicans in his last season. He was really what I would call an unlikely player that would have gotten to the majors, right? Probably if it hadn't been for the situation. Because, you know, just a year before, he's playing part-time, and then the next year he's in the majors. I mean, that's not – you wouldn't hear of that today, right? So,
but to get to play at Ebbets Field, how cool is that?
Yeah, that was for sure. I wish you know, as I went through that, I wish I had an opportunity to talk to him about that, because that's really where the fun stories come in. And what I found through the writing is when you can talk to the players or their family members, it really makes a difference.
Me too.
Yeah. Your aunt Joan, I talked to her, and she gave me a lot about the personal life, and that really helped fill out the story pretty well. And so, made for a full biography of not only his playing career, but what he did after his playing career, what his family, you know, growing up, what his family was like. And that's the part I find interesting.
Well, I'd find that interesting too. I'd be curious if you remember some of the details that she gave you. My dad tells his favorite Stan Musial story. When they were in the minors, Stan the man was insistent on pitching, even though he was an outfielder. And Fats, of course, was the catcher. And Stan Musial gave up like 17 runs or something crazy. And so the manager came out and said he was going to take Stan Musial out. And Fats said, well, you're going to take me out too, because he was drenched in sweat. They were wearing flannel uniforms, right. And so he never pitched again after that. Stan Musial.
Yeah, that was his last year. Yeah, that's correct.
But do you remember any stories that she told you, my Aunt Joni, about Fats or maybe Stan Musial?
Well, he was in the Dodgers team was traveling on a train. I forget from which city to which city, but there was a train wreck. He wasn't on the train. He left at a different time from some others, and a few of the players actually got banged up a little bit on that. So that was pretty interesting.
I thought you were going to say killed.
No.
I always found interesting that my pawpaw and Grandma Hilda had four kids. They had three daughters before my dad was born, but there was another John D'Antonio born before my dad,
right,
who died. How old?
I think and very young, a child, you know, very much
like an infant.
An infant, correct, yes. Yeah, that's right.
I guess if they hadn't tried for a boy, I wouldn't be here. But even if that death hadn't happened, then my dad's not born and I'm not born.
Sure. Yep.
So you talked about Milwaukee having a devoted fan base and packing their stadium. You mentioned us having the Pelicans here in New Orleans at one time. Why don't we have a major league team? And is there talk of us ever getting a major league team here?
Well, give you a little bit of history on Major League Baseball in the city. Actually, a number of major league teams used to hold their spring training in New Orleans for a number of years, Yankees included. And so there was a strong following back in the 30s, 40s time frame. So when the Superdome was being conceived, one of the thoughts was, well, we'll have a baseball configuration so that we can host Major League Baseball team. So as early as probably 1969, 1970, before the dome's completed, right? I mean, it's in construction. They were out pitching, the city and the state were out pitching New Orleans to get a franchise. And several teams that appeared, you know, going through the reading this through the newspapers, appeared to be interested. You know, the Twins, the Orioles, the A's, at different times, you know, entertained the thought of relocating their franchises here, but it never really happened. And I think the biggest problem was they didn't have a big money backer here in the city who said, "I'm going to take control of this." Kind of like a Tom Benson now, or a Rita Benson, who's that's their, you know, they're gonna support, they're gonna bring the team, they're gonna make sure it happens. So it really would never happen. And so they used to have exhibition games, major league exhibition games in the Superdome, and they were using them as a way to demonstrate, you know, boy, we could draw crowds here. Well, it really didn't happen. Mm. It really wasn't as much. The Superdome had some early problems with the field that got a bad rap. The Superdome kind of got a bad rap, which there were things that could have been fixed. But that it never really occurred. And so about probably in the mid-80s, I think they finally dropped trying to get a team here. And I don't think at this point, I don't think they will ever have a team here. We don't have, again, the money backer. Apparently, the Superdome's outdated for baseball. They'd have to build a stadium. I just don't think the city can fund that, or I don't think anybody's going to come here to do that at this point. We lost the Zephyrs, what, in 2019? I'm doubtful we'll ever get a minor league team back. I mean, it's a shame, but Major League Baseball restructured the minor leagues this past year. They got rid of 40 teams. And trying to improve or get more efficient with that, and I just unless somebody else just drops out, or you know, I don't see the New Orleans getting another team at this point.
For those listeners not in this area, Tom Benson was the owner of the Saints before he died. His wife own the Saints now?
Yes,
she does. Okay. Rita. Yeah. So I didn't realize the Zephyrs were no longer a team here. So they were eliminated in 2019.
That was their last season. Was in 2019. The franchise, the owner moved the franchise to Tulsa. Of course, there wasn't a minor league season last year, so they didn't play. So, but last year was the first time baseball hadn't been played here in the professional level since 1992. I think is when the Brewers first brought the minor league team here from Denver, and really. There never was a local ownership. It was always somebody brought the team here to – I think there may have been some minor, you know, minority owners in the club, but no one really ever stepped up in here. Now, Tom Benson actually had thoughts of trying to bring a minor league team here before the Zephyrs came. And he was trying to line up a double-A team, but he got Major League Baseball trumped him. Brought in the AAA team in 92, I think.
That's a shame. I feel like AA baseball is the best brand of baseball from a professional perspective.
Probably right, yeah. Still young enough to do a lot of crazy stuff, and then but they're eager to get to the next level, right? They're wanting to get their time in the show.
Yeah, I have a good buddy that played for the Zephyrs, and he talked about AAA baseball and just how different it is. You have guys who are.
On their way out for their career.
Got Benito Santiago, 37 years old. Right. You have guys who walk into the clubhouse and Sports Center's on TV, and they just resent the guys who got a shot and they didn't. I mean, the disparity in income is so vast, right? You walk into the clubhouse after making $1,200 a month and see your buddy on TV who you know you're better than. Right. He just happens to play in a different organization and he gets a shot and he's playing in the big leagues every night in front of 40,000 people and getting these massive $1 million checks.
Yeah.
It's got to hurt. But that organization, the Zephyrs, they were, it seems like Brewers, they were Dodgers, they were Marlins. Why did that change ownership so much? Or affiliation, I should say.
I mean, it's really up to the Major League Baseball as to who they decide who gets what teams, and so when one team leaves an area, they'll try to fit another team there, and so different franchises got involved. I mean, probably the most successful one was the Astros were here. That was the year 1998. I believe they won the World Series, the minor league World Series that year. Lance Berkman, Roy, what was his name?
Roy Oswalt.
Roy Oswalt. Players like that carried the team.
I remember when Berkman was coming out of Rice, which is in Houston,
right.
There was a big stink about whether or not he'd be able to hit with a wooden bat. As somebody who played college baseball and went to play in wood bat leagues in college, there is not a big difference. Right. If you can hit, you can hit.
Right. Yeah.
So I just thought that was so ridiculous. And, of course, he proved everybody wrong. So is that stadium going to sit empty now,
the Zephyr Stadium? Actually, the local professional soccer team has taken control of it, and they're going to play their full season there. They've tried, I think, a few high school games there, football games. They made a configuration. I don't know how successful those were. Right now, the soccer team's.
I didn't know they had one here.
Yeah, is playing their games there.
So as you know, Fats played at every level of minor league baseball, and I know many minor league teams have scrapped their teams. Does that upset you a little bit? I mean, baseball's changing, and I don't know how many rounds of the draft we're going to have anymore.
Well, they're talking about 20, which used to be 40, right? And then last year they had only five. So
well, when Piazza was playing, it was
right,
53.
He was like number 50-something, right? So minor league baseball, I think, is where I think a lot of kids grow their interest. So it saddens me that they've got fewer those teams, because that means fewer cities are going to have that available to them to grow the fan base. And that's a big problem right now with Major League Baseball is they're not getting a new wave of kids that are following the game daily. I mean, they'll occasionally go to a game. They might have one favorite player, but they don't. It's not like when I grew up, or certainly probably when you grew up, where that was a big deal. Major League Baseball was a big deal, and it's lost some of its luster, unfortunately.
That's true. My friend is the head coach at Nicholls State down the road, and he was telling me that the kids don't watch baseball anymore at all.
Right. Major League Baseball has a Jackie Robinson Day where every team wears number 42 on their jersey. They said half the players don't even know who Jackie Robinson is. That's pretty sad, right?
That is.
So, the Major League Baseball is trying hard to change that. They're, you know, New Orleans has an academy for youngsters to learn the game, learn not just to play, but all aspects of managing a baseball field, you know, the business of baseball, in an effort to try to get more kids involved at an earlier age and kind of get them hooked. A number of major league cities have done that. New Orleans was fortunate enough to get that, where the kids, you know, get firsthand playing and raking the field and cleaning the dugout and, you know, preparing for the games with selling the tickets, so they get the full breadth of operation of a baseball team.
Mm.
It's pretty interesting.
The book you brought me this afternoon has the Atlanta Braves 90s team. They had a bit of a dynasty there. I got hooked as a kid watching both the Braves on TBS and, where I lived in South Louisiana, we got WGN.
Right.
So I got to watch the Cubs, and the Cubs appealed to me more, and I think it had a lot to do with the day games. They didn't have lights back then.
Right,
I don't think they got lights until the late 80s.
Yeah, I think that's correct, yeah.
So. And Harry Carey was just more engaging.
Right.
You'd walk through the den and on your way to go throw the baseball outside with your buddy, and just hearing his voice, I get nostalgic just thinking about it. Yeah, there were a lot of Cubs fans who grew up around here, and when I was that age, we would go to Houston and watch the Astros play. Our vacation was scheduled around when the Cubs were in town. And I believe Ryne Sandberg must have gotten hurt on turf at some point, because I remember my dad and my brother being so disappointed that Sandberg wouldn't play the night they would go to the game. So my brother's favorite player was Ryne Sandberg. I got to like Mark Grace quite a bit. But in, say, 1987 to 1989, my favorite player was a local product.
Right. Will Clark.
Will Clark.
Yeah. He was a favorite of a lot of folks at that point in time. He hadn't had to play hurt as much. He'd be in the Hall of Fame right now. A lot of people think he should be anyway. But his first 5 years that he played, I mean, he was one of the best players in all of Major League Baseball. At one point, he had the highest contract signed. Of course, they were changing every other year during that period of time, but he was a fantastic player. And, of course, you know, being a Jesuit local, my son went to Jesuit. He was like, followed him. Of course, having the Mississippi State background, he played at Mississippi State. Was really had a fantastic career.
He played at the same time as Rafael Palmeiro.
Yep. Bobby Thigpen.
Bobby
also. Jeff Brantley. All of them. They had some good teams back then at Mississippi State.
So your interest in Will Clark was because of New Orleans, Mississippi State, but did you follow his career closely?
Yeah, I did.
When he was with the Giants?
Yeah. At one time, I claimed to have every baseball card ever produced of Will Clark. Of course, when they started making them by the hordes, I had to drop out. Yeah, I followed his career very, very closely. I collected a lot of notes about his career. And that was one of the stories that I wrote in the for Crescent City Sports. I did a 9-part series about Will Clark that covered each major phase of his career. Like I said, I wish he was in the Hall of Fame.
We used to have a mirror on our front door at home, and I would take a bat out in the driveway and try to mimic his swing in that mirror, which was impossible to do. And it probably did me no good because as a hitter, you can't mimic players' swings as much as you try. But, man, he had the sweetest swing. I should get on YouTube one day and just go look at him hitting.
Have you seen – there's a I think it was on Twitter. There's a guy – he's probably in his 40s, and he mimics Will Clark's swing. It is it's unbelievable. It is so like it. It's,
really?
It's pretty cool. Yeah, so wow. –
So
I guess he's been practicing this for years, and so he's got it down pat.
So I read one of your articles and learned that his first year of eligibility for the Hall was 2006, and he needed 5% of the vote in order to be considered
to stay on the ballot for up, at that time it was up to 15 years, but he didn't make it. Now he got considered again. I think as recently as about 3 years ago. They have a veterans committee that looks back at players that didn't make it, get second consideration, and he missed out again. He had to get like 16 votes, and he only got like maybe 10 or 12 out of the voters, and so he missed out again. His numbers, if you look at it on a, you know, in the current analytical approach, he was up there in, you know, batting average, on base percentage, slugging percentage. He just, when his career, when he missed a number of games later in his career, his overall production went down, and I think that affected him. He didn't have enough strong years to get to the Hall of Fame.
Now, one of the things you had written in this article that I read, you had said at the time of Clark's nomination, he told MLB.com that it would be a big time feather in the cap if that happens, but if it doesn't, that's okay. Because I didn't play this sport to get into the Hall of Fame. I played this sport because of the challenge and competition. My initial thought when I read that was, as evidenced by all these guys being left off because of steroid usage, guys like Bonds, for example, Clemens, I think the Writers Association are taking these guys' personalities into account. Pete Rose, for example.
Kurt Schilling,
his politics,
right,
they don't
exactly,
like.
Right.
So him saying that would be a big feather in the cap, to me that reminded me that Clark turns off a lot of people. And when I had the head coach at Nichols on, he and I were talking about how a lot of all-time greats were just pricks. They were total a-holes. Bonds, Ty Cobb. I don't know if Clark was to that extent a-hole, but do you think that works against him? Or maybe talk about why is that perception of Clark,
well,
why does it exist? Is he an a-hole?
Let me answer first.
Yeah.
He was cocky.
Yeah.
He was confident.
Yeah.
He was confident in his ability. So he knew he could hit. But he was brash. I mean, he pissed people off in the clubhouse. And with the Giants in particular, there were several players that just rubbed the wrong way. And I think, you know, that probably that got evidenced by writers and other people. But, you know, I don't think it's any different than what we would see today, to be honest with you. But I think at that time, maybe it was a little thought to be a little off base to have that kind of attitude. But in the end, he got misjudged, in my opinion. Of course, I'm biased, right? I'm biased about it. But
so we talked about my grandfather. He played with the Brooklyn Dodgers, obviously. You had an article recently about nice guys finishing last.
Right.
The origins of that phrase are from the Brooklyn Dodgers, right?
Right. So Leo DeRocher, this was in, I think, 1947. They were in the run for first place. And they played the New York Giants in a three-game series. And in one of the games, the Dodgers lost, but the Giants batters hit three home runs in the game. And Mel Ott, who's a local New Orleans Hall of Famer, was player manager for the Giants at the time. So the next day after the game, one of the local sports writers is sitting on the bench with Leo DeRocher, and he's kind of needling him, kind of see if he could get him excited, because he was known to be controversial and say controversial things. So he said, well, come on. He says, Leo says, you know, I know you won the game, but those guys hit three home runs off of your pitchers. And DeRocher says, yeah, but he says, but those are, that Mel Ott guy, he's just a nice guy. Their whole team is just a bunch of nice guys. And he says, look where they are. They're in last place, and I'm in first place. And it's like, nice guys finish last. So it got attributed, actually, to Mel Ott as the player he was talking about when DeRocher said that.
So, and Mel Ott is Jesuit.
Well, no, he was old-time Gretna. He was in the 1920s. He was before. He grew up in Gretna. As a 16-year-old, he signed on with the Giants. By the time he was 19, he was playing and leading the league in home runs. And when he retired in 48, he was the National League leader in home runs with like 502 home runs. He's probably the best all-time player from New Orleans.
So what prompted you to write about nice guys finishing last?
The Mel Ott connection for Crescent City Sports. Sort of my role is to write about baseball history. Everything else on that website is current day games. So they kind of look to me to kind of bring up some of the historical aspects, and understand they get a pretty good response from that.
What's the most interesting discovery that you've made in trying to connect players and relatives, and maybe something that really surprised you or, wow, I didn't know that?
Wow. One of the families that I found that I called the first family of Major League Baseball was the Harrison family. You may not be familiar with them. They were...
Is that Jerry?
Jerry Harrison was Jr. was one of the most recent players. But Jerry Harrison's grandfather, Sam Harrison, actually played in the Negro Leagues in the 1940s and got his cup of coffee with the White Sox, played only about five games. A cup of coffee is you get one shot and you don't stay very long.
That's in the big leagues.
That's in the big leagues, right. So it turns out he had three sons that played professional baseball. Two of them made it to the major leagues. Jerry Harrison Sr., John Harrison, who actually I wrote about, I wrote his biography for a book called One Hit Wonders. And then a third son, Sam Jr., who made it to the minors but didn't make the majors. Then Jerry Harrison Sr. had Jerry Harrison Jr. and Scott Harrison. And then his other brother had like multiple siblings, all of which got into the minor leagues but never got to the majors. But all total, there were 10 players in that family that played in professional baseball at three generation levels.
Jeez!
And so I felt that was pretty amazing.
When you said one hit wonders, the guy who came to mind was a New York Yankee, Kevin Moss. You remember that name?
Yeah, but he played. He got more than one hit though. he didn't stay very long, but
It seemed like he hit 10 home runs in his first 15 at bats.
He hit like 17 home runs and about 100 at bats. You know, to start his career, he didn't last very long after that. But
I think of Chris Sabo and Jerome Walton. They had a rookie of the year battle.
Yep, yep.
Jerome Walton was a one hit wonder, not exactly one hit,
right,
but you know what I mean.
Yep.
So you're wearing a Yankee cap right now. Why is that?
Well, I guess I. I've been enamored with all the history and lore of the Yankees, you know, going back to the very beginning. There's just so many fascinating players that in the era, you know, the different dynasties that they had over the years. I just got intrigued by that. Mickey Mantle was a favorite of mine growing up, and I used to have arguments with my brother about who was better, Mantle or Mays, right?
Do you have a favorite Yankee of all time?
I'd probably say Derek Jeter.
Interesting. Yeah. A new timer.
Yeah. And maybe because I saw him play more.
So yeah. How did you feel about them tearing down the old Yankee Stadium?
It was probably time to go. I got a chance with my son to go see one of the last games in that September before they quit using it. And it's nice. It's a lot of nostalgia there, right? And it was fun.
Now the new one's basically a replica, right?
It is for the most part. Yeah, it is.
And, just bigger.
More modern. It's got all the modern amenities, and you know it's you can sit in the certain part of the stands, and people come take your order for your concessions and come bring them to you, and it's really nice.
Now, did LSU do the same thing and basically build a replica of the old Alex box?
You know, I don't know.
It seems similar to me. I played in the old Alex box, okay. And I went for the first time to watch them against Nicholls State a few weeks ago. It seems similar, but I played there, but that was now 20 years ago, so it could be different, and I wouldn't realize it. They have a stacked team, huh? They must have a lot of major league prospects on that team.
The LSU team?
Yeah, like Dylan Cruz, I think, is that his name, Dylan Cruz?
He's a true freshman.
Wow. I think he has something like 8 home runs in 16 already. Games or something.
Yeah.
And then we already talked about the pitchers. I saw, what is his name, Drost, hit probably the hardest hit ball to right field I've ever seen. I mean, just crushed it.
Right.
But they were hitting doubles in the gap after doubles in the – I mean, it was just a hitting display.
Well, they have Devin Fontenot is a closer. He's been there, I think this is his fourth year. He'll probably get drafted. He's been pretty effective as a closer. They got a second baseman is Cade Doughty. He appears to be I think on a good track. So
yeah, he's putting up some big power.
Overall, they got a pretty young team this year, though. Actually,
so it seems like everybody does. That must have something to do with COVID too.
I think some of the players didn't come back. Yeah,
But you pull for Mississippi State, huh?
Yep, that's my team this year. They got a of course a couple of years ago. See, 2019, we got to the World Series. In fact, that was one of our trips my son and I made when we make an annual baseball trip. And one of the stops was in Omaha because we thought we were going to be able to get to the finals of the World Series. We saw a game between Vanderbilt and Michigan, but it wasn't State, so we missed out on seeing State play. That was an experience.
Was it last year that Vanderbilt had two pitchers in the top five picks or something like that?
Well, they're coming back. They're there this year.
Oh, okay. So they were going to be.
In fact, one of them just threw a no-hitter, struck out 15 batters. He's the son of Al Leiter, who is a major league pitcher. The Vanderbilt player's name is Jack Leiter. Huh. And then the other good pitcher is, I forget his first name, Kumar. I can't remember his last name, but he's probably a number one draft pick, actually.
Now, is the Fontenot kid related to Mike Fontenot?
I don't know. I didn't make that connection.
I remember we struck out 17 times playing against Lamar University. This was my junior year. And the guy who struck us out 17 times went on to be the Southland Conference Pitcher of the Year. This must have been 2004. I ran into him at a Baker Street pub in the Rice University area of Houston, and he was talking to a buddy of mine about what kind of juice he was taking. It was so commonly used at this time that they would talk openly about it, and he was using words that I wasn't familiar with, like wind straw and all these different types of test. And I thought, oh man, well that's not fair. I wonder if he was taking it when he was striking us out 17 times. Well, do you know that he gave up the home run to Bonds that broke Hank Aaron's record.
Oh, really?
And at that time, he was not a known user. And I don't even think he was a starter. He was like a middle reliever in the big leagues at this time. And I remember seeing it on SportsCenter and thinking, I bet you people have no clue that that little 5'10 pitcher is also taking
right,
the juice.
Juice too, right?
So. Yeah, and he ended up being suspended for 50 games within a year or
oh, really?
Two.
Okay.
Yeah, his name is Clay Hensley.
Okay.
Yeah, so did you collect baseball cards at all growing up?
I did as a child, and it was the kind of thing where I lived in a little small town, so you could, you know, for a couple of nickels, you could go and buy a couple of packs of baseball cards at the drugstore. Of course, in college, I didn't collect, but after I came to New Orleans, was on my own, I got back into collecting baseball cards at that point. So,
do you have favorites?
Favorites?
Favorite cards, or maybe cards that are worth a lot of money?
Unfortunately, I collected a lot of cards in the late 80s when they produced billions of them.
Same here.
I have some of the older pre 1960 cards. One of them is Willie Mays. It's not in all that great a condition, but I have a Mickey Mantle that would have been in like 1957 is one of the hotter cards, but it's got a big tear and down the side, down the middle of it. So.
And now they're ridiculous about the mint condition.
Exactly. I mean, that's gone. Baseball cards are so hot right now. It's unbelievable. Mike Trout card, like he's only like been in the league 8 or 9 or 10 years. You know, one of his cards recently sold for several million dollars. How can that be? You know, it's like, it's one of these cards. It's a one of a kind. It's in mint condition. And so the market's really gone off the scale.
So is that what these manufacturers do? They just, through scarcity, increase the value? Like, I'm only going to make six of these and then make it worth a lot of money? Is that how they do it?
Like Topps now, a lot of their cards are produced on demand. In other words, they advertise, we're selling this card. At the end of the week, we're not making any more. So if you want it, you buy it. Right, and so some of those cards have a run of just a few hundred, maybe a thousand, a couple thousand, and that's it. Right, whereas, you know, when we bought cards in the 80s, they made millions of a Will Clark or whatever.
Oh yeah.
So it's really changed a lot. And I don't keep up with all of that. They still make the sets and the boxes, the 700 cards. I buy those. That's it.
Do you?
Yeah.
I used to do that sometimes, but there was nothing more fun for me than buying a box and opening the packs.
Sure. Yeah,
so. And it was so hard for me to save the packs and not open them. But I would start. Right. I started a little business at school right. Where I would take the packs to school and sell them for $2 a pack.
Yeah, you know.
I made a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of money to a 12-year-old, anyway.
Right. But I had about 1,200. I have about 1,200 Will Clark cards, different cards. And they're probably like 2,000, if you will, nowadays, you know.
Huh.
And they're still making his card. I mean, they're retro cards, but all of these newfangled sets are come out with the retro players. You can still find his, you know, a 2020 Will Clark card is still out there.
Hmm.
So
my mom and dad, when they were still married, went to San Francisco in, I think it was 89. And they went to a Giants game and sat behind first base at Candlestick Park. And they brought a baseball card of mine to get signed by Will Clark. Now, what are the odds? And my dad said that he told a security guy or a cop that was on the field, hey, will you tell Will Clark that I went to Brother Martin? And the cop said, you tell him. My dad said, okay. Hey, Will,
yeah, right.
I went to Brother Martin. And he came over and they talked for a minute and he got the card signed.
Nice. That's cool.
You know, I was laying in bed the other night and I was thinking, what if they actually didn't get his signature? Well, you know, I was an 8-year-old kid. Maybe right. They just signed it themselves. Yeah, I should ask him about that.
Well, I think it was 1989. In fact, the year that the Giants and the A's played in the World Series. You know, that was the earthquake year.
Yeah,
they actually played an exhibition series in New Orleans at the Superdome.
I didn't know that.
And my son took his cards. Mark McGuire, Will Clark, Jose Canseco, and went out into the one part of the field where they were, and he actually got them signed.
Get out.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Oh, those teams were stacked.
Yeah, right.
Dave Stewart.
Dave Stewart, right.
Who else?
Kevin Mitchell was with the Giants, right? He was one of the better players.
Jeff Leonard.
Yeah.
Remember Kevin Mitchell made that one-handed catch in the outfield with his bare hand?
Yeah.
That's incredible. There was probably the coolest experience I had at that age. I was either 7 or 8, and the LSU basketball team played an intra-squad scrimmage at Thibodaux High School where I was living. And our coach took us to the game. We got to sit on the front row, and so we were looking at up at these Giants. And we all knew who Chris Jackson was. He was the star. But Stanley Roberts was this incoming freshman, and we all paid a lot of attention to him. But there was this other 7-footer named Shaquille O'Neal, and we didn't even pay that much attention to him, but it was such a show. And this had to have been 87 or 88, and we got a picture of the team, and Dale Brown signed it. And, of course, I just hung it on the wall and would run into it when I'm playing Nerf basketball in my room, so it's in terrible condition if I still have it. Did you know Ron Washington at all?
No, I never met him. I haven't written anything about him. But his career was pretty interesting in that I think he went to John McDonough High School here in New Orleans, which for baseball was not that prevalent.
It's like L.B. Landry down the street.
Right. So, but he got enrolled in an academy that the Kansas City Royals put on, where they took players, amateur players, and said, "We're gonna teach you how to play baseball." So he got enrolled in that camp. Actually, several players, and they actually wind up getting into the major league. So they spent like 6 months in Florida and played baseball every day. And then the guy who owned the team would make them go to school classes in the afternoon, so it wasn't just baseball. And that's how he got his start. And then, of course, he eventually signed a contract. I don't think he actually signed the contract with the Royals. I think he started out with maybe the Twins, I think.
And that was like the Dominican before the Dominican, it sounds like.
So he was a good utility player. He didn't hit all that much, but he was apparently a good team player and a good guy to have around on the team. Of course, then he managed the Texas Rangers, from 2007 to 2011 or 2012, and they won two pennants with the Rangers. And what was that? One year they came within one pitch with the Cardinals of winning the World Series. It was the seventh game of the World Series, and they wound up losing.
And then there was a scandal at the end of his managerial career.
Yeah.
Didn't he admit to cocaine use?
Yeah, I think
something?
He wound up admitting to that. And unfortunately, it took him out of a manager's type job. Now, he's been with the Braves right lately as a coach.
So
he's still in the
that.
Game. Apparently, well liked. Players liked playing for him. He was just he was a player's coach. And, I remember during one of those World Series, they showed him, in the dugout. He would stand on this top step, and when one of his players, got a double or somebody was making a steal, they showed him. He was jumping up and down in the dugout like a little kid. Mm. I mean, he was just, he was in the movie Moneyball.
Did you ever see that? I did, yeah.
He was the coach they called Wash when they went and talked to the guy from the Red Sox. Said, "You're going to be a first baseman."
Oh, yeah, I was a big fan of Moneyball. I remember reading it and telling my dad he had to read this book. I thought it was fantastic. I came up in that era and prided myself on taking a lot of pitches and drawing a bunch of walks, and I never felt like my coaches appreciated it very much. But I wish that they had read that book, too.
Washington was an old-school guy. I mean, probably still is. And you would wonder how he would make out today as a manager with all the new – fangled analytics and all that. Dusty Baker is the manager of the Astros, and when they let go Alex Cora after the he moved on, and then they fired they brought in a new coach and fired him immediately because he was also related to the scandal. They hired Dusty Baker, and he came out of the blue, old school, and it's like, how's this guy going to manage? But he did, and they said he's adapted, and he's like takes all the inputs from all the people in the front office that are generating all these numbers, but then at the end of the day, he makes up his mind what he's going to do. And so,
I remember reading the book about the Astros where Hinch was going through the interview process, and they asked him what they thought about the lineup being sent down from the front office, and Hinch said that that wasn't okay with him, and they said, good, yes, you know the players intimately, how they feel, and so that's the right answer, and they ended up, of course, hiring them. And then after the Astros stealing signs scandal, they, of course, kicked Hinch and Cora out, fired them, but they were both back in baseball almost right away.
Right.
As
Hinch is back this year with the Tigers, and then Cora is back. Went back to the Red Sox.
Speaking of the Sox, the White Sox. You wrote about Comiskey Park at one time. What's your interest in Comiskey Park and the White Sox?
It was one of the Sabre books where they picked some of the old time. This is the old Comiskey Park.
And Sabre is Society for American Baseball
Research. Yeah, so it was one of those books that a number of us collaborated to write about some of the players and some of the games. So I had several game accounts of games that were played in Comiskey Park. So
I know one of your goals in retirement is to visit all of the major league parks.
Yep.
How are you doing? Are you trending? Are you going to accomplish your goal?
I'm about halfway there. I think 18 out of 30.
It's pretty good.
But I've probably seen games in, I think, another 15 parks that are no longer there, right?
So, Comiskey.
Comiskey, the old Comiskey being one of them. But I've been to the current Comiskey park. And so my son and I have been taking these annual trips ever since I retired, and they're pretty fun. So we generally try to looked for the multiple cities that were in close proximity. So we would catch a game like in New York on Friday night, Philadelphia on Saturday night, and Washington on Sunday. And so we'd take the train and went, and that was a pretty good trip. We did San Diego, Los Angeles. Of course, there's two teams in Los Angeles. But the latest trip in 2019, we did the Cubs, White Sox, and the Brewers, since Milwaukee's only about 80 miles from there. And then, of course, we caught the World Series game in Omaha on the way back. So the teams that we haven't seen are mostly in the isolated areas, and so we probably have to just make a solo trip to Detroit or Minneapolis or Cleveland or whatever. Some of them are close, so we might try it. But one of our secondary goals on these trips is to try out all the Italian food in these different cities.
Awesome.
My son and I both like to eat, so it was that's also part of the planning is, okay, what Italian restaurants can we find? one interesting one was in Chicago. We found this restaurant, and it had good reviews. Didn't really know anything else other about it than what we could read on the internet. And so it was a night game, so we said, we'll go get a late lunch and then head to the stadium. So it was in the restaurant was in the business district area. So we walk in, we're like prepared to go to the game, right? Shorts, tennis shoes, baseball caps. So we walk into this restaurant, and they says, can we help you? I said, well, we'd like a table for two. And she kind of looked back, and she kind of studied us, and she said, I'll be back. So she went off, and she brought a guy, probably a manager or whatever, to the front and said, she said, these two gentlemen would like a table. He just kind of hemmed and hawed, and so Lee finally said, well, you know, we'll if you got a bar, we'll just eat at the bar. And they were like, so we figured out we weren't dressed for the restaurant. In fact, it turned out to be it was a fine dining Italian restaurant. So we managed, though. We said, look, if there's a table in the back, we'll do that. And we promise we'll take our baseball caps off. Well, we actually get in, and the bar is the premier seats in the whole restaurant. So that's why we got that look. But that was, we got some good homemade pasta, and that was one of our fun trips. So
do you have a favorite park, or at least give me your top three?
Well, you know, the Yankee Stadium, the old Yankee Stadium, Fenway, and the Dodgers are the oldest parks that are around. And, of course, they have a lot of the nostalgia and history around those. But actually my favorite is the PNC in Pittsburgh.
It's, because of the view,
yeah,
it is something.
It is been. Really. That's really. It's just the whole setting there. It's on the river. It's in a nice, nice area. The park has kind of got the old style feel to it, intimate feel. And I think that's my favorite.
I'm with you. It is a great park. Now, since the old Yankee Stadium has been torn down, I would think there's no park that can't be torn down. Do you think that could happen to Wrigley and Fenway?
Probably eventually. I think eventually they will, yeah. I think just that's the way baseball is changing. I think what you're finding is a lot of people running these teams now that don't have the ties to the old way things were done. There are a lot of strictly businessmen, MBA, Ivy League types, and they strictly look at it as a business. And that's what's brought about this whole analytics approach to baseball.
Mm-hmm.
It's how do we improve? How do we spend our money? And that is really dominated the sport. And in fact, a lot of people believe it's ruined some of the charm of the game. That people that are not tied to the old way things were done. Major League Baseball Commissioner's Office hired Theo Epstein. He quit with the Cubs. And his goal, his charter is to figure out a way to bring the charm back to the game. So what does that mean? It's like, are we going to get away from all, defensive shifts and, launch angle and exit velocity and all that? Probably not, but it'll be interesting to see what they come up with to try to do that.
Odd that it would be him that
right.
they would put in charge
exactly,
of that.
Right. So.
I hear you, ruining the charm of the game. So from what I understand, they're going to try quite a few things in the minor leagues first.
Right.
Like in extra innings, maybe putting a guy on second.
Well, they actually are going to do that in the majors this year.
Oh, is that right?
They did it last year in the shortened season.
Oh, I didn't know
that.
When
it first came about.
Oh.
And they actually are going to do that again. That's one of the ones that's going to hold over.
Any other changes that you know of?
In the majors, they're going to do 7-inning doubleheaders, which they did last year. And other changes that they made, the expanded playoffs are probably not going to do that. The universal DH is not going to be this year. That's probably going to come up the next year when they have a new collective bargaining agreement. There's money involved in that decision. So, but in the minors, what they're doing is one league is doing a 15-second pitch clock instead of 20 seconds.
Mm.
One league is doing the bases are bigger.
Okay, and that's to prevent injury.
Well, that I think, and also to try to encourage more stealing. Right, because the bases are now closer together, right?
Oh, so they expanded the width of it.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I thought they were making it taller.
No. It's the size of the, I forget what the square.
Huh.
If it's 12 square inches, it's going to 14 square inches or whatever.
I would love to see more stealing.
Well, that's part of the charm of the game that's been lost is that nobody, the value of a steal now is very low in today's game. What else? So they're gonna one league's gonna try the robotic ump, call it the automatic balls and strikes.
I wanted to ask you about that. Are you in favor of an electronic strike zone?
Yeah, I think it's fine.
I'm surprised to hear you say that. I'm in favor of it too.
Yeah.
I think it's inevitable.
I think
it's gonna come.
I think the accuracy is gonna be helpful. You'll still have an umpire that still has to make calls, but you just he'll get something in his ear that says it was a ball or strike, and he'll take that. So.
I think you're going to see more upsets. I think the Yankees are going to go down more because there's a lot of favoritism that goes on, especially in college. I was telling somebody the other day that the two at-bats that I remember most, you always remember your home runs, but right. The negative at-bats that I remember were being called out on a strike three playing at LSU in my first at-bat and playing at UL Lafayette in my first at-bat. These pitches were like the width of my laptop outside, probably more than that, which is the size of a home plate.
Right, yeah, that's right.
I wanted to tell the umpire, you're only doing this because they're LSU and I'm Nicholls State.
That's right, yeah.
How does that make you feel? It's so bad.
Yeah.
So you have 12 stadiums left to see. What's next? Where are you headed?
Well, I was talking to my son the other day. And he has restaurants in Tampa and in Dallas. So I think we're going to do, when he's there for business, I'm going to meet him out there for one or two games in Tampa. And then in Dallas, they have a new ballpark, ballpark at Arlington, whatever there, that barely got used last year.
Mm-hmm. I was fortunate to go to the World Series last year.
Did you?
Yeah,
wow.
That park is amazing. Yeah. There's nothing old-timey about it, though. Very modern.
Right.
It's like being in a mall. It's symmetrical. Yeah. It's
Well, they said from the outside, it looks kind of funny, right? Somebody compared it to a tabletop oven or something. It's something strange like that, and it's apparently a modern look for the stadium compared to some of the more traditional ones.
As somebody who's traveled the world quite a bit, it feels very America. Like, what is this other stadium doing here? What a waste. Because it's right across the street,
right, exactly,
the old ballpark in Arlington. And then you walk into, there's a big bar to the right of the entrance, the main entrance to the new park. And you walk in, and the first thought that I had was, oh, everything's bigger in Texas. Like, there's this bar with this gigantic TV screen that, really? I mean, it is probably like 30 feet by 20 feet. I mean, it's just humongous. And then, of course, they have a million other TVs, and it's two stories, but it's just grand, and it's really nice. So it's a cool place to go before the game.
That would be an example of where it would be the third generation ballpark I would have attended Dallas or Fort Worth.
That ballpark wasn't around that long, right? 94, I want to say.
Yeah.
Have you been to, well, first, since you mentioned Tampa, I should say I've been to that stadium. It felt like I was in Japan's single A, like their nicest field in their single A minor league program. It's bad.
That's how I felt when I went to see the Marlins play when they were in the football stadium. That was terrible. That was the worst. I think that was probably the worst baseball park I've ever been in. It just wasn't suited well for it all.
The upside of the Tampa stadium, it's a dome, is that you can get seats behind home plate
like
10 rows up for $36 or something.
Yeah.
Do you have something that you're going to publish soon that you want to talk about?
Well, I mean, really, what I'm continuing to do is just work on more biographies of players. One that I signed up to do was a guy named Charlie Gilbert, played in the 30s, 40s. His brother was Tookie Gilbert. I did one of him already.
I read it. Yeah.
And then Lenny Yoakum was a player in the 40s, played, he says, a cup of coffee and a piece of apple pie with the Pirates. But then he wound up being a Pittsburgh Pirates scout for like 35 years. His daughter called me a couple weeks ago and said, hey, I saw the story that you did. I really appreciate it. You captured Lenny's love of the game. She said, I got all this stuff I don't know what to do with. She said, I need somebody to help me figure out what it is and what I need to do. She says, otherwise, I'm just going to throw it away. So I go over there.
You must have been like a kid in a candy store.
I was like, she said, I go through the thing. I looked at it, and it's like, a lot of it was personal. A lot of it was just scouting reports that he did. You probably could go through there and find a few scouting reports that were pretty interesting that somebody might be interested in or whatever. And he had photos, a few photos. I think they had gone through and picked out anything with autographs and all his baseballs and all that stuff. They had already taken, obviously had all that. But so I said, have you considered, local library, maybe taking some of it? Yeah. About a sports memorabilia. Somebody wants to, we sort through this. She said, yeah, they don't really care to look at it. Hall of Fame. Nah, they said they got too much stuff already. So I kind of went through all those, and I said, well, I'm not sure what your options are. And she says, I think I'm just going to shred it. I said, wait a minute. Are you serious? She said, yeah. I said, before you do that, let me look at it. So she sent me home with 12 boxes of stuff. And so what I told her what I would do was I would scan in the stuff that I thought she would be interested in. All the photos. He kept meticulous records of games he played in, had the dates, the articles and whatever. So I think I scanned in almost 500 images of either photos or letters or whatever that he had. And so I called her the day and said, look, I'm ready to bring this stuff back to you. I mean, this is, she's, oh, man, this is great, And so there's actually a couple of, scrapbook kind of things that she actually wants to keep, that were his. And it's like I was in hog heaven, man. I tell you, I just to a lot of people, it probably wouldn't have meant much at all, but just you know, just little things like you. And this is where I think when I do the biographies, if I can talk to somebody, talk to the person or their relatives, it really makes a lot of difference. Because, you know, in here, he got selected to go play in like an all-American, all-star game in Brooklyn when he was in high school. I mean, you wouldn't find that anywhere else, right?
Yeah.
And they got a picture it's like this big of all the players that Whitey Ford was one of the players he played against, right? And in there, it's got Leo DeRocher, Branch Rickey, you know, Lee McPhail are all in the photo. And his coach was George Sisler, was a Hall of Fame player, right?
Hmm.
You never would know this kind of stuff. One of the guys that I wrote an article about, Nolan Vicknair, he'll be 96 in a couple of weeks. He played a cup of coffee in even just the minor leagues, right? And he never got out. But in his career, he met Branch Rickey, Mel Ott, and Carl Hubble, you know, all Hall of Fame, either front office or players, whatever, as part of his minor league experience.
Hmm.
And to hear him talk about those guys and talk about players he played against, it's like, to me, that's the enjoyment I get is hearing those kind of stories. And then, like you said, you know, when you get one published like that and they're like, thank you for, you know, the Fassian family. Did you happen to see that?
Yep.
The two brothers and the father that had all those championships.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, they were thrilled.
That's awesome.
So I get enjoyment out of nobody else that I know of in New Orleans writes about the old-time players anymore. In the, you know, in the Peter Feeney days and the, you know, Bob Rossler, Ron Brocato, those guys that worked, they did stories like that fairly frequently because they knew a lot of these guys at a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, a lot of those players are gone now, but nobody writes about those kind of things anymore. And that's kind of the niche that I'm – and that's the feedback I get from the Crescent City sports guys is people apparently like that because they can tell by how many people are reading the articles. And they said that it's an area – you know, it's something we don't do otherwise. Everything else we do is current. Yesterday's scores, tomorrow's, you know, Saints game or whatever. And so that's kind of what I'm focusing on.
You did some of that, right? Because I read an article about Altuve when they were
occasionally, but they tend to want me to focus on New Orleans related because their website is New Orleans, South Louisiana, LSU, Tulane, Saints, you know, kind of thing. That's what they focus on.
My grandfather told a lot of stories when I was a kid. And I was just getting at the age where I would really appreciate them. But I remember hearing the names that you're saying.
Yeah.
And I would give anything to hear those stories
again.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. There was a picture that was framed that he kept above the bar that he owned or the sandwich shop. I guess a bar / sandwich shop. I'm not sure. And it was four players in their baseball uniforms. And Musial was one of them.
Okay.
And my grandma was a hoarder, but I don't know if she hoarded the good stuff, but that's how I got that autograph Stan Musial ball, is it was just kind of sitting there up on the shelf. But this framed picture that I only got to see once, I believe it was sitting on the floor, leaning up against the wall. Well, I guess what happened to it?
Flood.
Katrina took it out.
Aunt told me most of that stuff got ruined.
Oh, she told you. Did she give you any gushy stuff? Like, I remember hearing stories about lipstick on his uniform.
What she told me was that, you know, after he played, I think he owned or operated a couple of bars for like over 40 years, and that people would just gravitate to him because he was so personable, and that he just everybody knew him. And that you know, that was part of his legacy was he was a great guy that everybody liked to be around. And, he started the Babe Ruth League level in the early 50s in New Orleans. He got involved also with when the Nord New Orleans Recreation Department got started. He coached a number of teams in there. That was a day when players came back to New Orleans and they lived here and they got involved in the community. They got They coached the kids. There's a guy named Doc Leggett. Didn't have much of a baseball career, but he was a NORD baseball director for like 40 years. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he did was he would go around and have these spring before the season started. He would get kind of – he was looking for funding for his department. So he would take people on these tours, mm-hmm. and he would get former baseball player, you know, major league players to come in with him and be part of the marketing effort. So, well, she did tell me about how he got the nickname Fats.
Oh.
So when they were 8 or 10 years old and they were running around in the neighborhood with, and they would play their games, uh-huh. One of his friends was Russell Gildig.
Yeah.
He would just – it wasn't because he was fat or overweight or whatever. It was that he just – that name, nickname stuck. And in fact, Gildig turned out to be a lifelong friend. They actually played together with the Pelicans for a year. He operated the bar with your granddad also, so they knew each other all that time. But he's the one that gave your granddad the nickname Fats. And it was just, hey, you know, hey, Fatty, hey, Fats, mm. you know, type thing. And but not because he was chubby or mm-hmm. overweight or whatever. And,
yeah, my grandma yeah. always called him Fatty. If he was in the other room, hey, yeah. Fatty! Yeah. Right. Talk about Babe Ruth's connection to New Orleans. Did he play here a little bit?
I think I told you that the major league teams, several major league teams, used to do their spring training. This was before Florida and Arizona became popular spring training mm-hmm. sites in the late 40s and early 50s. So those teams would come south to play. And the Yankees came, I think, several years. And he came with them here. And I think 1923, I think, was one particular year that they would typically go and make a stop in Hot Springs, Arkansas, do some training there, take advantage of the hot spring baths and whatever, mm-hmm. and then they would come to New Orleans. And the story about him is that he one of the stories is that I wasn't able to substantiate this, but I've heard it several times, so there may be some truth to it. Got a little drunk one night, and of course they had curfews, and they were staying at the Roosevelt Hotel. Back then it was the Roosevelt Hotel.
There's a Roosevelt Hotel here now. Are you okay. saying it was a different?
Well, Roosevelt? No, it was the same hotel. It changed. Remember, it changed names at one point.
Oh, I didn't realize
it,
that.
It came back as, as the Waldorf Roosevelt. Mm. But anyway, some teammates had to sneak him into his room to keep him from getting fined. And of course he was known for a lot of eating and drinking, and that the newspapers talked about all the restaurants that he went to the racetrack, and they took him fishing down in the bayous one day and whatever. One year there was a woman made a charge that she had relationships with him, and that he had to fight this. And so when he came to New Orleans, he kind of got out of the New York arena where they were where this is a big issue. And the story was his wife came to New Orleans that spring also to kind of keep tabs on him. So I don't know if any of that. The newspaper account, I did find the newspaper accounts about the accusations the woman made. Now, whether his wife was upset about it, I don't know.
Now, when you go to Camden Yards in Baltimore, you can walk to Babe Ruth's house where he grew up, right? It's right around the corner.
Right close there in the nearby area, yep.
So. That's very cool. Okay, so I want to ask you some fun questions if you have time.
Sure.
What is your favorite Italian dish? When you go to these restaurants, what do you typically get?
I'm a sucker for homemade pasta, so anything that's homemade. I don't know. One of the restaurants we found in I think it was in New York had a gnocchi dish with a gorgonzola sauce on it. It was out of this world. And I don't know if you've ever eaten. Uh-uh. It's like little potato dumplings, and then you put either sauce or red gravy or whatever on it, and it's like it's pretty good. So my grandparents in Mississippi made gnocchi with sweet potatoes instead of the, you know, white potatoes, and that was one of their favorite dishes. So whenever we go to a restaurant, when they have it on the menu, say, "Well, do you ever heard of sweet potato gnocchi?" And they were like, nah, that's not possible. You know, nobody does that. And it's like, yeah, well, they do. So, I tend to favor more the dishes, the non-traditional types of Italian dishes, where if you go, like, to Mascas and, you know, the chicken a la grande with all that garlic is super, you know. So more than just the lasagnas, ravioli, pasta, meatballs, whatever. But
what is your favorite Italian restaurant in New Orleans?
I would have to say Ristorante Filippo over in Metairie, right off the causeway. They got a really good red gravy, red sauce. It's kind of sweet, and I don't know, we don't make it that way, but it's really different.
I've never seen somebody's face light up so much talking about food.
Yeah,
that's great. Social media, net negative or net positive for society?
Net positive. I think I see a lot outside of the business world. I see a lot of people that use it for connections that otherwise would never happen. You know,
true.
I mean, I'm not a big user myself, but my wife at times has been, and she's connected with people that never would have found otherwise, you know, went to high school or whatever, and they pick up right where they were 20 years ago or 25 years ago.
Well, I don't think I'd be sitting with you here today if it weren't for Twitter.
Right, correct. That's right, yeah. So, I tell you, the one that's fairly new, fairly recent, is The Athletic. That is really a first-class operation. They cover all sports. Of course, I'm mostly interested in baseball, but they cover all sports. They got writers there that got laid off, and all these other ESPN and all these other places recently. They've managed to collect all of those, and there's top quality writing and thought leadership, and that's probably my favorite.
My dad had always subscribed to Sports Illustrated when I was a kid, and then when I was in college, I believe I was in college when ESPN the Mag came out. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that can't be any good, ESPN, the magazine. And sure enough, we subscribed, and it was awesome. I was very impressed with ESPN, the magazine.
Well, it was non-traditional for the time, right? Because it had a lot of it was pictures, a lot of it was current, mm-hmm. you know, celebrities. A lot of it was not even sports-related. And they would bring in fashion and all, you know, all other kinds of things that appealed to people. So I think that's, to me, that was a different generation of people that it attracted, I believe.
So did you subscribe to many sports magazines throughout the years?
Yeah. I still do. So Baseball America, Sports Illustrated, Baseball Digest. I recently turned off ESPN Magazine because it wasn't stuff that I was interested in anymore. The Baseball Hall of Fame has a Memories publication once a quarter. That's really first class. It does a good job. Stuff like that.
And you get hard copies delivered to your house?
Yeah, I'm a hard copy guy. I mean,
I am too. I still get the Wall Street Journal. I alternate papers a lot of times.
I've still got them in a lot of most of those in my library. I mean, it's like my wife it's like kills me every time one of those comes in. She's like, you need to throw one out. And it's like, no. I think I've kept every Sports Illustrated I ever had.
My dad's the same way. I'll bet your library is impressive.
I like collecting books. I read probably half of them. And that was one of the things I thought when I retired was I'll just have time to read all these books that I bought that I hadn't read yet. And
do you find that you're just as busy in retirement?
Yeah.
Me too.
For sure.
And I wonder all the time, like, well, how do people have time when they have a job?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same way. And I think I use them in my research. So, I mean, of course, a lot's on the internet, but you've got articles and whatever that you're not going to find there. And I've got, fortunately, I have them all cataloged, and I know what's in most of the magazines or the books. I have indexed it.
Wow!
So I can pull up a report of Will Clark and find the, you know, 50 or whatever articles or books that were written about him.
Oh,
so I use
awesome.
That a lot in my own research.
So what are you working on right now?
I am working on, actually I'm working with Sabre on a project to collect all the employee information that's in media guides. So, of course, you got all the players and managers, but then there's the general manager, the front office people. They want to create a database of all of those employees for the major league clubs. So I'm just typing in. I have most of the media guides going back to 1970. So I don't have to scan. I don't have to look to somebody to get them. And it's, I mean, it's a simple, it's mundane, type it into a spreadsheet. But it's we're making really good progress. And I think they're about to publish that later this summer, at least the first version of that. So you would be able to search this and say, when was Bobby Cox? No, well, that's probably a bad example because he's a coach or a manager. But Branch Rickey, when was he the general manager for the St. Louis Cardinals or the Pittsburgh Pirates or whatever teams he was associated with? And so people use that in their it's a research tool for people that are writing about those front office personnel. So I'm doing that. I'm working on a bio for Charlie Gilbert, one of the three.
Isn't there a stadium named after a Gilbert here?
There was a Larry Gilbert Stadium at one time. I don't know where it is, but Larry Gilbert was the father of these two players.
Okay.
And he was the manager of the Pelicans for a long time.
Oh, okay.
So he was a very, very popular guy here in New Orleans.
And when you say Pelicans, you're talking about
the old Pelicans. Yeah, the old Pelicans, yeah. And then what else? I'm probably going to do a story about Lenny Yoakum with all the information I've collected about him or gotten from his daughter. There's a lot of good stories in there about him.
And do you have a schedule when you wake up in the morning? Do you write for 3 hours or research in blocks of time or anything like that? Do you find that your attention span has waned with the advent of technology?
Not really.
No. That's good.
I don't have a most of these don't have a deadline, so I'm not trying to work toward. You know, the only deadline I have is I do a weekly blog on my own website. You know, for that I put out Monday morning. So that's the only thing I have that I say I got to get that done. Everything else I can. You know, the commitment dates are not firm from the people that I'm writing for.
Do you ever find yourself up late on Sunday night trying to meet your own deadline?
A couple times, yeah.
I do that, too.
Yeah.
Self-inflicted stress. It's ridiculous.
Right.
But I do it.
And it's like, it's not like anybody's really going to miss it if I don't.
Yeah.
It's like.
I know. Yeah, so I'm deviating from fun questions a bit here, but what about your will? Do you have a place where all of your indexed magazines and stuff are going to go when your time is up?
My children.
How many kids do you have?
I have four.
And boys?
One boy, yeah.
Is he interested in as interested?
Yeah, he's a pretty rabid baseball fan.
That's awesome.
And then I've got, you know, several grandsons, three grandsons, so some of them wind up hopefully in their hands.
And did all of you guys play baseball?
Yeah, I played high school. We won a state championship one year, and this is small school level in Mississippi. We had a really good pitcher that, if you can believe, he struck out like 75% of the batters he faced.
Whoa.
He like threw four no-hitters and didn't give up an earned run all year. So he was the main guy. I was a sophomore. I was the first time I'd ever really played at the high school level, and I was probably the worst guy on the team. I couldn't hit my weight, so.
I had a guy on the podcast, Brent McDonald. You might enjoy that episode. He talks about he had two first-rounders. These guys were in eighth grade at Sci Falls, where I went to high school. When I graduated, they were in eighth grade. Well, the school is ninth to 12th grade. One of them's right-handed, one of them's left-handed. They're both pitchers. They were expected to go third and fifth overall. The guy who went third had a money dispute, and he ended up going 15th. But he said that the lefty, his name is Scott Kazmir, he led the American League in strikeouts one year.
Yep.
He would strike out 19 of 21 hitters. He averaged 19 strikeouts a game. This is 5A Texas high school baseball.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
Pretty bad.
It's a pretty good, probably one of the better districts in the state, if not the country. And So they only had to get two outs a game. And so he said, we didn't take a lot of ground balls. There was no point. We tried to work on hitting. And then the other guy, his name was Clint Everts. He went to the Expos fifth overall. This is 2002. And he averaged 18 strikeouts a game. So crazy.
This guy, he was a left-hander. And I played second base. And we had the shift, defensive shift, before the shifts. I was second base, but I played over in the hole toward first base because batters, right-handed batters, could not get around on him at all. I caught more ground balls in the hole, and it just that was the way we knew to play it that way, and more often than not, that's where they went.
If I gave you $100,000 and forced you to invest it in one of these three companies, Amazon, Apple, or Tesla, which would you choose?
Probably Amazon.
Amazon.
And I think I just think they're still growing. I mean, there's all kind of stuff they're getting into. You know, you never would have thought about, but they're gonna dominate.
Yeah.
Dominate the world, I think.
Good choice. Do you invest in any sort of stocks?
Not individual stocks. I'm
an index.
More indexes and mutual funds. And
what is your favorite baseball related book? You mentioned Moneyball earlier.
My own book.
Yeah.
No, just kidding. I mean, I have a lot of favorites, but the one I read probably that intrigued me the most was about Billy Martin. It was a 2015. Bill Pennington was a beat writer for the Yankees and New York Times writer, sports writer. What was fascinating about it was everybody associates what he did with the Yankees. And all the turmoil, you know, five different times he was manager. But when he managed the Twins, the Tigers, the A's, Rangers before that, he turned those teams in. They were mediocre teams that he turned into winners. And he just, you know, talk about how would he do with analytics? He would totally reject that, right? I mean, he was definitely an eye test guy, and the reason was he had instincts just about games, about situations, about players. He had a lot of experience. I mean, he was a Casey Stengel protege, so he learned a lot about managing from there.
Mm-hmm.
And so this book is not just about his Yankees career. It starts from a managerial standpoint. Starts with his first job as a Twins manager, and there were consistent things that he did in each one of those that made him into winners. And it's like that was—I didn't know that before. I always associated him with Yankees winning a couple of World Series with them, you know, in the 70s. So
I'm just too young to remember Billy Martin. My only image of him is kicking dirt on an umpire. Yeah.
He was one of those characters of the game. I wrote a piece recently about baseball needs more characters of the game. He would be one that we need back in the game. It's gotten too bland. I mean, it's too...
You know who else would reject all these analytics is my Papa Fats.
Oh, yeah.
He would hate it.
Right. Right. Yeah.
What about a favorite baseball-related movie?
Let me think of it's the one that Kevin Costner was in. He was a Pittsburgh Pirates. I mean, a Detroit Tigers pitcher. I forget. For the Love of the Game.
That's yeah.
And
it's a good
pitched,
one.
He pitched the no-hitter on the game he knew was going to be his last. Remember, his arm was about to fall off. And I like that one.
I even had a tough time convincing my dad that steroids were so prevalent. Like, when I would go and play in Kansas, and the Jayhawk League was a little more prestigious back then, probably second to the Cape,
right?
At least half of my team were
really?
Using them.
Really?
Yeah. And it was guys you wouldn't think.
Yeah.
And everybody was looking for an edge. And they say Bond started using them because he knew he was more talented than the guys that were putting up better numbers than him. So he's like, screw you, I'm going to start using the juice. And
so do you think he should be in the Hall of Fame? Clemens, Ian Clemens? Manny Ramirez, Sammy Sosa.
I hate just the thought of it, because there are so many guys, like I was just saying, who you wouldn't suspect who are using it. If Clay Hensley was using, who was giving up Bonds' home run, then what do you do?
Right.
So it's like all or nobody. Like somebody got in recently who I know is on. Was it Bagwell? Did Bagwell just get in the hole?
Yeah, a couple years ago, yeah.
Yeah, that guy's juicing for sure. For sure.
But they never had any positive, never had any positive examples of that, though.
So yeah.
He and Mike Piazza was another one that thought, remember, that he was using.
Yeah, and he probably was.
Yeah.
So many of those guys.
I tend to look at it from the standpoint of what's the whole body of work that they did?
Mm.
What's the whole career look like? Bonds was juiced or not. He was a really good player. Clemens, same thing. I mean, those guys were.
Yep. They were, no, you're right.
They were far and above. You know, who was that guy for the Orioles? Brady Anderson. One year he had 52 home runs.
Yeah.
Never came close before.
Yeah.
His body of work is not, you know, it's not that. So.
Or like Brett Boone. I think he juiced up to get a $100 million contract and then never had to juice again.
Right.
It was such a crazy time. I hate that I played in that era. I was one of those guys that was borderline. Like, I was told by my coaches, you got a 50-50 shot of being drafted.
Mm-hmm.
And so juice would have probably put me over the edge. But everybody had a reason to take it, right? Like I said, Bonds, while I was on the edge. And I never wanted to have to tell my kids that I used steroids, and that's why I didn't do it. Okay, last question. How can people find your work and connect with you online?
Well, there's several ways. I have a website that I support. It's called The 10th Inning, TheTenthInning.com. It probably has a link to everything else I do if you want to go to one place. I do a weekly blog with that. On Twitter, I'm at The 10th Inning is my Twitter name. On Facebook, it's The 10th Inning. Now, there are several out there. You have to find the one that's baseball-related. My email is richard@thetenthinning.com, so I can be emailed, and I'll respond to most everything. So.
Very good. Richard, this was fun, man. I appreciate you coming by.
Yeah, it's good talking baseball. I love it.
Likewise.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Friends, thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode with Richard, please copy the link and share it with a friend. And if you wish to follow my adventures on Instagram and Twitter, I am @man_overseas. Thank you, folks.